It's Wednesday, September 26, 2018, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry.
Hi, Amy.
On our program this week, we're going to flash forward because it seems all of the big media stories, they're all going to be playing out tomorrow. After what feels like about 10 days or so of negotiations, will they, won't they? Well, Christine Blasey Ford and Judge Brett Kavanaugh will answer questions before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein will return to the White House to meet with President Donald Trump, the first time they'll meet face-to-face following the New York Times exclusive from last Friday that Rosenstein had discussed the president's removal through an invocation of the 25th Amendment. And the premiere of the TV reboot that creator Diane English said just had to be because of all of this, the return of Candace Bergen as Murphy Brown. Let's start with what we know will begin tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock our time. The resumption of Judge Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee and testimony from the California professor who has accused him of sexually assaulting her at a high school party back in the early 1980s. Kavanaugh vehemently denies being at the party, says he doesn't even know her, reiterating his denial again in a 20-plus minute interview that appeared on Fox News Channel Monday night.
Were you ever aware of any gang rape that happened at a party that you attended?
That's totally false and outrageous. Never done any such thing, known about any such thing. When I was in high school, and I went to an all-boys Catholic high school, a Jesuit high school, where I was focused on academics and athletics, going to church every Sunday at Little Flower, working on my service projects and friendship with my fellow classmates and friendship with girls from the local all-girls Catholic schools. And yes, there were parties, and the drinking age was 18, and yes, the seniors were legal and had beer there. And yes, people might have had too many beers on occasion, and people generally in high school, I think all of us have probably done things we look back on in high school and regret or cringe a bit, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about an allegation of sexual assault. I've never sexually assaulted anyone. I did not have sexual intercourse or anything close to sexual intercourse in high school or for many years thereafter. And the girls from the schools I went to and I were friends.
So you're saying that all through all these years that are in question, you were a virgin?
That's correct.
Never had sexual intercourse with anyone in high school?
Correct.
And through what years in college, since we're probing into your personal
many
life
years,
here?
Many years after. I'll leave it at that. Many years after.
So, like I said, that was about a 90-second clip from an interview that went really more than 20 minutes. And throughout, Kavanaugh just said that he wanted to be having a fair shot. He wanted the process to be carried out fairly. At the same time, even just in that 90 seconds, he said a lot of things that could potentially set him and his nomination up for disaster, because it can just be destroy him tomorrow in that hearing.
So many things about that interview were just amazing to me. One, that it happened at all. We've never had a Supreme Court nominee appear to give a news interview before the confirmation hearing. Two, that it was on Fox News is not surprising at all. But Martha McCallum did a very good job of asking him some fairly tough questions, didn't let him off the hook. The thing of it is that he said the same thing for 20 minutes. He said the same thing 15, 16 times. So he was very well prepared. And what we didn't show in this particular clip, but of course his wife was there. And in addition to doing kind of the standby your man routine, she did answer a couple of questions, but he didn't allow her to answer the question about whether or not she thought the FBI should investigate all the allegations.
Some people were comparing that moment to a scene from The Handmaid's Tale where the commander character silenced his wife in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, I'm astonished, as going back to what Mike was talking about, astonished that he would even do this interview. I mean, it's just not something that Supreme Court nominees do.
No, they're kind of told to stay under the radar, don't talk to anyone, don't go grocery shopping. I mean, you get to eat, that's about it.
I mean, many of them don't even give interviews after they've been confirmed onto the court and they've made various rulings on certain things. So I found that to be unusual. I'm also not surprised that it was on Fox. But you're right. He was unequivocal in many of his statements. And that could come back to be a problem for him when these hearings start back tomorrow, because I can guarantee you that the Democrats on that committee are going to play that over and over and over again, and they're going to ask questions trying to probe a lot of the things that he said in that interview.
Using
to find
his
out
own
whether,
statements against
using
him.
Using his own statements against him.
I'm not even sure that we can safely say the hearings will start tomorrow. I mean, until the cameras go on and there's and she is sitting there and they start the first question, I'm not so sure, because now we have this entirely other allegation from Michael Avenatti, who started out as Stormy Daniels' attorney, right, and then he's maybe a candidate for president of the United States, and now he says he represents yet a third woman,
right,
who supposedly will come forward sometime maybe yet today. And what kind of bombshell will that be, and how will the media handle those allegations? Because there's been a little bit more dissent than usual in the way that news organizations have vetted the claims of the second woman who came
forward. The claims, and yes, the article in the New Yorker, the New York Times was among those that said they were aware of this, but did not feel that through their reporting that it was credible enough or bulletproof enough to run with the story the way that the New Yorker and Ronan Farrow did.
And really, when you look at this story, I mean, and other stories that have come out, especially in the Me Too, in during the Me Too movement, mm-hmm, news organizations are, in some ways, they usually follow in lockstep behind each other, and they sort of check each other's sources and that sort of thing. But in a lot of these instances, and here's another one, they're actually challenging each other's sources as to whether or not there's something there, yeah, whether the veracity of the information, whether or not it's credible, whether or not it's valid, and so now not only are you're going to have the Senate looking at Kavanaugh, you've got the media looking at the media. I mean, it's just become a cycle of who can we trust. Who's got the accurate information?
I mean, I'm glad that the media are being transparent about their differences and approaches to the story. Although I will say that just because the New York Times said they could not find independent confirmation, mm-hmm, despite talking to dozens of people, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, I mean, Ronan Farrow and Jane Mayer, mm-hmm, talked to Ramirez directly, as yeah, well as some other people the Times didn't get to talk to. Yeah. But another thing about the media that kind of interests me is, of course, the pushback now from supporters of Kavanaugh is that there's a media bias and that journalists are willingly going along with the Democrats, who clearly are, whether the charges are true or not, do have an agenda that they're trying to push. And I just wonder if it isn't like we've said so many times on this show, a lot of things can be true at the same time.
Right.
Reporters may have their own biases. They may not be all that sad to be doing a story about Trump's nominee. Clearly, the Democrats on the Senate and elsewhere have a campaign to try to knock him down. That doesn't mean the accusations aren't true, and it doesn't mean the reporting that's been done so far hasn't been pretty solid reporting.
I agree. I mean, and the other thing for me is that, you know, we keep talking about, what was the scope of the investigation of Kavanaugh by the Senate, by various agencies that are basically put in charge to do that, mm-hmm, prior to a nominee and his or her witnesses going before the Senate. And for this, I mean, you know, they knew about the letter back in July, but no one wanted to release it. The Democrats waited for the right moment for political reasons, all of that. If it was out there, you know, it should have come up at that point, and maybe we wouldn't be talking about this right now. But that in and of itself, I think, is also a part of the story that I just find a little bit troubling.
So, Mike, before we started recording today's show, you and I were sitting here and kind of talking a little bit about our plans for tomorrow morning, how we're kind of figuring out our work schedules, our class schedules, so that we can be in front of a TV and listening to this. What types of things are you looking to see tomorrow?
Well, I mean, in some ways, this has a lot of parallels for journalists of a certain age. I mean, I can go all the way back to the Watergate hearings,
yeah,
but certainly you've got Anita Hill. That's an obvious parallel. But this is going to be one of those kinds of stories where you're going to have all of the attention, well, maybe, of the media on something, and people are going to, O.J. Simpson, this is going to be one of those kinds of media events where people are going to be glued to their TV sets unless the president can find a way to divert us with Rod Rosenstein.
Right, and that is going to actually be what we were going to talk about next. So we might as well segue now. Tomorrow, Rod Rosenstein will face President Trump for the first time since the publication of a piece Friday in the New York Times, an exclusive that Rosenstein had talked about trying to invoke the 25th Amendment and remove the president from office. The two men talked on Monday, the president and Rosenstein. There was a whole lot of reporting that Rosenstein had offered his resignation before he could be fired. And there was one reporter who played it safe, NBC's Pete Williams, who said his sources weren't confirming the departure just yet. And in fact, as of the time we're taping this on Wednesday afternoon, Rod Rosenstein is currently still the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, which also makes him the only person who's overseeing Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. This really is another episode in the reality TV presidential administration, and in some ways may be that Trumponian diversion, deflection. That's exactly what they're looking for.
I think it's going to be, yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's exactly what they're looking for, but it comes real close. I mean, this could, if Trump has this meeting, comes out and says, we have an agreement that Rod Rosenstein will step aside as the Deputy Attorney General, and here's some reasons why I'm going to give for that, and then he goes on Twitter and goes off. Now all of a sudden you got eyes diverted. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's going to be enough to knock Kavanaugh off the top mantle, but it's going to be pretty close.
There might even be a third item that the president could use to try to divert attention, because hey, on Friday the government could shut down if we don't have a budget passed.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're laughing at things that are not funny at all, but it's just so bizarre that we're still in the position.
Could we roll back for just a second to that original story that the New York Times ran on the weekend about Rod Rosenstein that precipitated all of this, basically saying that he had talked about invoking the 25th Amendment and that he talked about wearing a wire in the White House to try to capture the president. Now, that story about wearing the wire led to some really interesting journalistic navel-gazing, too, because you had other news organizations like the Washington Post, for example, that said, well, our sources say that he may have meant that sarcastically when he talked about wearing a wire. Mm-hmm. The New York Times reporter comes back and says, well, but you know, if it was meant as a joke, then why would FBI and Justice Department officials be memorializing this in memos?
Right.
So I don't know what I believe, but I do know that there were an awful lot of New York Times readers who were pushing back on the Times for the first time in a long time, saying, what are you doing? Why are you running this story at this time? It probably came from some Trump sources, and you're handing him an opportunity to fire Rod Rosenstein. I don't know what I think about that argument, but there were hundreds and hundreds of New York Times readers who were calling him out for that.
Yeah, I mean, you've got sniping going back and forth between the Washington Post and the New York Times about this story and previous stories. And I mean, I'm not. It seems as though they're all talking to the same sources, but they're getting different information. Mm-hmm. And it just seems at times the New York Times is getting some information, maybe from Trump sources, as you said, Mike. But then at times the Washington Post is getting a perceived scoop that the Times isn't getting. I mean, all of this coming around at the same time, this is unusual, and to me, it's going to be hard for the public to basically figure out, okay, do I go here? Do I go here? What's going on here? And what's missing in all of this, which we talk about all the time, is context.
So while we're on context, there is, as you talk about the Post and the Times and who's getting what information when, there's an even more bizarre element to this, right? Ben Folds, the guy who made a name for himself in the late 90s with the hit song Brick, he wrote a song for the Washington Post about Rod Rosenstein.
God bless the bureaucrat and the lawyer too.
I will say that I'm very happy that I've chosen Rod Rosenstein and say not Scaramucci. Rosenstein is much more real and painful to me than the other stuff, because of the personal position he's been put in and the position that we're all in at these crossroads where we find ourselves deciding to stick up for our norms or not.
What do you call him, Mr. Bieber? Sends some thugs to smash his glasses. The institution standing, but we're trying our best to trash it. Aren't we all the keepers of this fragile young republic? And when all those Mr. Peepers people fall, Lord help us all.
So it's a catchy tune.
It's a catchy
tune. And the Post wanted to try to put some of this stuff in context using alternative storytelling methods. So now we have Mr. Peepers. The message of this song?
Well, that here is this bureaucrat and this nice guy, nerdy fellow who's being picked on by the president and the Republicans. And if we don't see
what's
going on there.
With references to Lord of the Flies.
With Lord of the Flies. If we don't see what's happening, that our democracy is in trouble. You know, it's a catchy tune, yeah, as you say. Now, the Washington Post ran it along with several other examples of non-traditional or alternative journalism.
A board game about education, right. Betsy DeVos, a Trump speech in the form of a Mad Lib.
Now, I wouldn't call this journalism in the sense of, you know, presenting facts. I would call it opinion.
Yep.
But it was a very effective presentation of, I mean, just think about it. How much time would the average person, if they see that story, they're going to spend at least the 4.5 minutes of that song on that site, and chances are they're going to read more, they're going to check out the board game, they're going to check out all the other stuff. If nothing else, it's a really engaging way to keep people on your website.
And I think, to me, that's the important part, is that it keeps them engaged and it causes them to think about, whoa, wait a minute, it's helping us to, at least what they're trying to do is help put all of this into some sort of context where people can say, wait a minute, we are talking about some big issues here involving the democracy, uh-huh, the small d, and not getting sucked into and wallowing in the politics involving the big D Democrats and the big R Republicans. And that, I think, is probably the most valuable thing that this brings to the conversation.
Okay, so in the grand scheme of things, this next thing also happening tomorrow may not be such a big deal unless you were a young, impressionable girl back in the early 90s thinking that maybe you wanted to be a broadcast journalist. In which case, Murphy Brown was just about everything, which made seeing this even more.
I left FYI a few years ago. You couldn't tell the evening news from an episode of Entertainment Tonight. The problem was I didn't know what to do with myself. And then we had an election.
We are the
I left FYI because the network asked me to anchor their morning show. Wake up, America. It was all going fine until the weather girl took a couple of weeks off for foot surgery. She came back to the show with double D's. When she stood next to the weather map, we couldn't see Oregon. The next thing I know, she's in, I'm out.
Okay, for the record, I was totally a Murph girl, not so much Corky Sherwood Forest. But Candace Bergen and creator Diane English said they had to reboot this show now. They couldn't let this time pass, kind of for the same reason you were just describing. It's bringing some of that pointed context back in a way where there's some comedy to it, too, or at least what the old Murphy Brown was in the days of Dan Quayle.
Yes, no. But my fear on this is we could have another Roseanne moment, on the other side. I mean, that's the fear of the show. I mean, I liked Murphy Brown. It was a good show. But that sort of bothers me in that regard. But also what concerns me is that when I look at how the makeup of this show, mm-hmm, I'm wondering whether is it actually going to reflect where we are right now in 2018 as opposed to too much nostalgia and too much of the
1994 happening today.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, they're kind of walking a tightrope here because they've decided in order to keep current that they're going to write scripts maybe only 6-7 days mm-hmm out sometimes from the taping and the mm-hmm airing of the episode. So that's going to be some pretty tough work. And I guess the other tough sledding they might have is that, I mean, CBS, among all the television networks, is kind of more known as the Middle America television network, the rural America television network. And yet, I mean, it's obvious from interviews that have been given by the producer and the actors in this that it's going to be all anti-Trump all the time.
Right.
I mean, they're going to attempt to be humorous about it, and that can make a difference. But there's basically, you know, 30% or whatever of the audience is definitely not going to tune in for this show. So maybe they get enough excitement from the other 60 or 70% that it works, but they're taking a chance.
Right.
Okay. Well, the Washington Post, Margaret Sullivan, wrote a column about what the next few days are going to be like based on what the past few days have been. It's a toolkit basically for journalists and news consumers. Her advice to us and to the consumers out there is we get through everything that's scheduled to happen tomorrow, read with a critical eye, question everything, think before you share.
It sounds so good. It makes so much sense. As you said, read the whole story. Consider the sources and wait and see till you get all the information. Be skeptical of the stories that you want to believe in. It sounds so good.
Yeah, it does. But
How many people
are going to do that?
Yeah, as we all know, that's not the way we consume news now. And then we've become so polarized in the way in which we do it that it's going to be difficult even for the journalists themselves to pull themselves out of that sort of he said, she said, is this playing to the right? Is it playing to the left? Where's the middle in all this? You know, it's going to be difficult.
So about a month ago, we saw it with the Manafort verdict and the Cohen plea coming on the same day and kind of the breathless way that the cable networks specifically kind of in the networks as well kind of went to it in the split screen of not knowing where to go first. The fact that these are kind of sort of planned events, do you think maybe there's a chance at some better, more responsible reporting tomorrow?
I'd probably be proven wrong, yeah. But I don't think that the networks carrying the hearing or for all the other websites are going to carry it live are going to do a split screen with whatever happens with Rod Rosenstein. I just don't think it's going to happen. During breaks, they will bring it up. But I think that everybody is so anxious to hear what Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh have to say right in front of tough questioners that I don't imagine them breaking away.
I mean, I agree with Mike. I mean, I don't imagine that they're going to break away from that, because what you're going to have in Kavanaugh, in the Kavanaugh hearings, is not as staged as what the Rosenstein is mm-hmm. going to be. And I think that's going to be the difference in terms of how the media plays that.
Okay, so let's change gears entirely and talk about some of the images that we saw on TV yesterday. Again and again, we watched bailiffs march Bill Cosby out of a Pennsylvania courtroom and to begin serving his 3 to 10 year prison sentence. It's the next chapter in a sad, sad story, but it's also one that we know isn't over yet because of promises of appeals. It's the first celebrity that has gone to trial and is now convicted and going to prison since the start of the Me Too movement.
It's tough. I mean, I watched those images and just to me, the most stark images is mugshot. Mm-hmm. And to think about where Bill Cosby was in his career. I mean, you know, I go back to reruns, early reruns of I Spy, mm-hmm. you know, to where we are now, and you kind of go like, man, how did this happen? How did we get to this point? But as the judge said, the evidence is there. The evidence is overwhelming. And no, I'm not going to let you go home while you appeal. You know, you're going to go to you're going to go to prison, and then you still have people saying, well, he got off light. You know, you have people saying, wait a minute, he should. You know, if this had been Joe Sixpack, he would have been in jail for almost for life. So, you know,
for an 82-year-old man.
Yeah, no, I get you, but I'm telling you, this is what people are saying.
Just really quickly, I'll say there are some potential parallels between this and Kavanaugh. I mean, Cosby got off with a hung jury on his first trial.
Yeah, he did.
But on the second trial, the judge allowed 5 other women to come in and testify, and then he's convicted. If the other women who've accused or witnesses who could support Christine Blasey Ford were to come forward, there might be a similar outcome for Kavanaugh. And that's why I think the Republicans on that committee are trying so hard to limit it just to the two of them.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
patterns may...
So
it seems everyone and their brother has one these days. Even this program appears on iTunes as a weekly podcast. It's the new trend for television station groups. I'm seeing it appear over and over in discussions among our alumni. Who has a successful podcast? How did they cut through the clutter? How do you build an audience? But at the same time, it's starting to look as though maybe that bubble is starting to burst. BuzzFeed, in the last week or so, has cut its podcast unit, pivoting again to video. Panoply has ceased production. Really, people are finding this is a lot harder to do. It takes a lot more work, a lot more time, and there's an oversaturation, and it's not worth the investment it once was.
I guess what I would say is, though, I think the stories we've seen in the past week are kind of clickbaity, and that's kind of ironic because BuzzFeed is the one that's dropping its, you know, in-house audio production to do video. it's true that there's an art and a science and a business to doing podcasting well. I mean, one, it's got to be part of your mission and your strategy. You've got to do those programs really well, and you've got to target an audience that appreciates them enough that they're either going to, you know, the advertisers want to get to them, or you want to subscribe to them. And there are lots of people doing really well at this right now, but there's going to be people who are going to fall off the cliff if they don't have sufficient energy or commitment or whatever to do it right.
And I think when you talk about commitment, I think it's the return on investment part here, is that I think you had certain media organizations that got into podcasting hoping that it was going to be a quick hit, hoping that they were going to be able to see some revenue coming from that in the near future, and were not thinking about playing it through for the long game. And now that they didn't see that, they're sort of like, no, I won't want to back out. And you can't.
You listen to many podcasts, yeah, you've heard every Blue Apron commercial there is.
Yeah.
not a whole lot of opportunities for advertising there.
Right.
One last thing I wanted to bring up to the two of you before we run out of time today. What does your DNA sound like? It might sound like a goofy question, but maybe not so much now that Ancestry and Spotify are talking about a new partnership. Buy one of those Ancestry DNA kits, send in your swab, and Spotify will build you a custom playlist with music that matches your ancestral background. One of the links on our links blog in the URL that went with this literally had the words "no thanks" built into the URL because it sounded like such an absurd idea to them.
It's clever. I mean, you're paying $99 for the Ancestry.com, you know, DNA information. Why not, if you're Spotify, say, hey, we can identify music that fits the cultures that you might not even realize are in your DNA or your background. And if you're a big Spotify listener, I'm not one of those people. I'm still one of those people that likes to own my own digital music. But if you're a Spotify listener, mm-hmm, it might be kind of entertaining to have them create a playlist for you. But it's really something that if you care about your culture,
but
you can do your own playlist.
You can do your own playlist. And I get 5 playlists created for me by Spotify a day,
yep,
that I didn't have to give anyone DNA in order to be able to get access to that.
No, thanks. I'm good. I'm good. I can take care of this myself. And you know, if you're going to pay the amount of money, mm-hmm, that they're asking for the testing and that sort of thing, I don't know if I necessarily want that. But as Mike said, I mean, it is creative, and some people might want to see, well, hey, you know, I didn't know I had this. What kind of music does this particular culture listen to? So, you know, who knows?
Okay. Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today and an interesting investigation from Golf Digest that resulted in the exoneration of a man who'd been in prison for decades. You can find that under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music, Ellie Fitzgerald is our social media producer, and I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you next week.